The Sunday Scripture Podcast is a weekly look at the scripture passage coming up on Sunday morning. I'm Joe Cate, and I'm joined by three of my favorite people to talk to on any subject. My brother-in-law, Carl, from Clover, my brother-in-law, Shane, from Elgin, and one of my best friends in ministry, Brad, who serves with his wife, Megan, at Bethel UMC in downtown Spartanburg. Welcome back to the Sunday Scripture Podcast. We continue in our series of Lent, Foolish Love, where we read passages. Each Sunday we read two. Sometimes we choose one of them for the sermon. Sometimes we choose both, Brad, Megan, and myself on Sunday morning. They are not beside each other in a gospel. They're often in a different gospel. They are not necessarily connected in ways that the authors of the Gospels would connect them. They're connected by this theme, building in Lent, where we are recognizing the sacrificial love of God, the occasional mild to moderate judgment of humans of that love, and our ability to learn and grow into living into that love in a way that some people would say is foolish. We are reading a classic story from Luke, chapter 15. It's the third of three stories of something significant being lost in chapter 15. The first one is one sheep out of 100. The second one is one coin out of 10. And now we're going to talk about two brothers. All of these stories are responses to something that happened in Luke 14, where Jesus is arguing and debating with religious leaders over who should be included. We think that is a significant part of what contributes to these stories being told. Parables, illustrations for the people, so that they can better understand. Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the wealth that will belong to me.' So he divided his assets between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and traveled to a distant region, and there he squandered his wealth in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, severe famine took place throughout that region, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that region, who sent him into the fields to feed the pigs. He would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. And put a ring on his fingers and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his elder son was in the field, and as he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on. He replied, "Your brother has come home, and your father has killed the fatted calf because he got him back safe and sound." Then he became angry and refused to go in. His father came out and began to plead with him. But he answered his father, "Listen, for all these years I've been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came back, who has devoured your assets with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him." Then the father said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found." Shane, what do you see?
Sorry. So he was dead, he was lost, and now he's been found is the question. But my question is, because he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating and no one gave him anything, why would they not give him anything? Right? I kind of understand the lot the I don't truly understand he was dead but now was found. But how does that correlate back to they wouldn't give him anything?
Yeah, I think it's probably Jesus's way in which he's telling this story to demonstrate how truly desperate this young son is, that he has fallen on, like basically he has fallen lower than he's ever imagined before. He can't even get help from other people, that he has nothing. And it's only then that he turns his life around to return to the Father.
Okay, but then he references his father's slaves having extra bread to spare. So I'm having a little bit of confusion that where he was, no one would help when he was feeding the pigs, but yet, he believes that his father's slaves had something to spare.
I think he's remembering how good he had it at home, that even the slaves had food to eat at home. Here he is in another country. He's been able to get a job to feed the pigs, but everybody around him is treating him lower than the pigs. They're not giving him anything. He's remembering how good the slaves had it at home. So he's starting to get homesick, is how I read it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. And I mean, don't miss the fact that, like, if he's a Jewish individual, feeding pigs would have been not great. They are not kosher animals, and so they are considered unclean. And so to include that little detail is to tell you how far he's fallen. And he's just so desperate that he's starving, and yet all he can think about is the fact that even the lowly individuals back home had food, and what he wouldn't do in order to have that food as well.
It's fascinating, Shane, that you pointed that out because we circled that tonight. I had never noticed that before. No one gave him anything. So as much food as the workers had where he was, he's working on some level that is so desolate that there is nothing to share.
Yeah, I mean
Shane,
that, yeah, don't miss that point, because in verse 14 it's the severe famine. So there's a reason why there's nothing to share. Like there's, it's not that people are just being mean, it's like there isn't anything.
is there a tie to the severe famine in Egypt and Joseph, or would that be more likely if it was Matthew that told this story rather than the author of the Gospel of Luke?
I mean, there might be some correlations, but famines were more common. I mean, famines were common, period, like historically. You know, but I guess the lesson that was learned from previously is that a lot of the times when famines occurred, people had kept reserves. And so like this young man doesn't even have anything in reserves to be able to call upon. So he's got no connections for help and he's got no reserves. He hasn't planned accordingly. So sheer desperation.
So he has no reserves because he had his share of the wealth and, as it says, squandered. You know, I would assume that being the case versus understanding, you know, living within your means and being prepared.
Right. Yeah. So he squandered it all. I mean, obviously this individual in the story that Jesus tells shows like he's not responsible in any way, shape or form. So that's kind of par for the course for him.
And, you know, in literature and pop culture, this story is retold all the time in different ways. But basically, this young guy has been given his inheritance before his dad has died. And the fact that his dad was willing to give him part of his estate, probably prematurely, is also really interesting, a point of the story. But when he goes into the other country, I mean, he leaves the country, so he's not held accountable by his family. And he's living the wildlife. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, any decadent rock and roll band we ever thought of in the 70s and 80s and 90s. This guy is just living high on the hog, so to speak, until the famine strikes and he runs out of money. And now not even the hogs can be kind to him. So he's just hit rock bottom, the lowest of the lows in this story.
There's a comment tonight at Three Friends that he distanced himself in order to squander it. We draw away from the group in order to make some of our worst decisions. What do you think of that?
Exactly.
Yeah, I think Carl hit it on the head. He left so he wouldn't be held accountable, right? His father or his family would be, you know, challenging his decisions. You know, and, you know, to some account, and he could go off to another country and just do as he pleases. I believe in what Carl had to say for sure.
Do you think he looks ahead at his life in farming? Everything's mapped out. It's a railroad track, although railroads don't exist. I'm on this path. And this is all I'm ever going to do. And I'm willing to blow it up and have no net just to not have to do this.
I mean, maybe if this is, you know, culturally a more conservative area in which there is expectations for people to live a certain way, I think it stands to reason that a number of these folks would have gone elsewhere seeking fortune, seeking, you know, adventure, seeking whatever it is that you do with desolate living. And so he didn't want to be held down by that, I guess. I guess you could make that case.
I thought about the workers hoping to be hired throughout the day in another of Jesus's parables, and this man desperately hoping to be hired after squandering the money. People are put in vulnerable positions for their occupations in a lot of Jesus's parables. And I think a lot of people can identify with that. Being in a vulnerable position and hoping that someone grants them an opportunity, certainly being in that position. The thought of the word worthy in 19, I'm no longer worthy. The comparison of that against give me the share of the wealth that will belong to me. He thought he was absolutely worthy of the money that day. Everything that's coming to me, I'm due that. And I need you to come up with it and give it to me now. Versus being in the broken state and saying, I'm not worthy of the thing you would give me.
So what? Why does Jesus, in telling this story, tell us how the son is rehearsing what he's going to say to his dad? Why do we get that version? And then when he sees his father, he doesn't even get a chance to really get it out. His father has already decided to bring him in, embrace him, and throw a party when he sees him from a distance before even hearing from his son. I find that interesting that Jesus tells us what the son intends to say, and then he really doesn't really get to say it because his dad has already forgiven him and embraced him. I find that that's extremely gracious on the father's part, and I think that that's part of the theme here during Lent that we're talking about when we tie these stories together. But this this part of the story is really interesting to me every time. Jesus tells us first what the son is gonna say, and then we get to see him try to say it. I find that storytelling technique interesting.
And I've, in past readings and past sermons, Bible studies, whatever, I've wondered if he was rehearsing what his father wants to hear, but I get a better feeling for that and the purpose of that in exactly the way you asked it, is he's saying, I can come up with what, you know, describing the darkness that I generated on my own, the trouble that I'm in, and then he doesn't get a chance to share it. I love that. As a person who isolates when overwhelmed and then churns and thinks about all the aspects of the issue and what it's going to take, the ladder it's going to take to get out of there. Sometimes the depth is not near as low and the ladder doesn't need to be near as high. So I love your idea of the rehearsal sets up the fact that there's no need for a rehearsal. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think Jesus, by explaining the son is rehearsing, and these are my words, rehearsing, Jesus tells us what he, when he came to his senses, he said. So thinking in those terms, I feel like the son, his heart has changed. When Jesus tells us the story, we're learning that the son's heart has changed. Whether he's rehearsing it just to get back in favor with his dad, I never see it that way. I see it as true repenting. And his dad doesn't even have to hear from him. The fact that he's come back is action enough. You don't have to fill in the gaps. You don't have to fill in the blanks. The dad sees him from a distance, and he's already made the decision that he will embrace him and welcome back. It's extremely gracious, generous, and I think that's the point of Jesus's story here.
That's fascinating, Carl, to hear you say that, because I just got finished probably about two weeks ago, we had a knockdown drag out with our 12-year-old daughter. I guess they did this story in their youth group. And so she came home one night and was fired up because she does not believe that the son is repentant at all. She thinks that the son only comes back because he's desperate. And she was so mad about the way in which the story was told. And it just was fascinating to try and get my mind wrapped around, my head wrapped around the 12-year-old brain trying to process this story. Because she's taking it as face value and being like, oh no, he's not apologetic at all. He's not sad. He's not repentant. He simply is desperate, and it's out of his desperation. So he shouldn't be forgiven. And like, she was hardcore stuck on this for a while. So I'm glad to hear your statement that, because I thought I was crazy for a little while.
Well, but his brother sees it that way.
Mm-hmm.
His brother is livid. He doesn't buy it for a minute. And you know what? It doesn't matter whether he's being to the father. It doesn't matter whether he's being sincere or is just completely desperate. He has come back to the fold, and the father loves him so much that he is willing to kill the fattened calf and give him the best robe and all of that stuff. And he tells the son, who's griping, that you're with me all the time. You're here now. This other son, the younger son, he was dead to us, and now he's back. Let's rejoice. You know what, guys? I've talked about this on the podcast before. I resonate with this because being in a 12-step program, this is what this is about. This is somebody who is at rock bottom, comes to a group. A lot of the old timers will call it Sunday school for dummies. But you come to the 12-step group, you learn how to acknowledge that you are powerless and that you need some help. And you reach out and people help. And when we help that person, we embrace them and we bring them into the fold. And you know what? A large percentage of them go back out and make some of the same choices and same mistakes again. And we love them unconditionally. And when they come back, here they are again. But we embrace them. And it's hard to do, especially when you get a knucklehead who goes out multiple times and comes back in. And you go, okay, well, is it going to stick this time? It doesn't matter in the moment. What matters is that they've come back. And that's how I see this story. It's very personal to me.
I appreciate you sharing that. One parent in the group tonight asked, I wonder if this is not about parenting. Is this just simply about the love of God that humans are trying to learn? What do you think of that?
All right, say more again. Say it like
this is not a story about parenting. This is a story about God's love for humanity expressed in the way that Carl just shared it. Because sometimes we read it and we're like, well, I mean, as parents, as children, we read it and struggle with it sometimes. But it's really not about a parent and a child. It's about God and a human being.
Yes, I would say 100%. And I can say this with a little bit of experience, because I have seen too many instances in which parents have used this, good God-fearing Christian parents have used this story as like parenting advice, and they've kept taking in their deadbeat children over and over and over again, and they're constantly being used and abused and bled dry by children that are just never going to change. That sounds very harsh. It's just kind of raw, because there's a couple of folks in particular that I think of in my past that, like, man, their children were just prodigals and they couldn't cut them loose. And it is painful to watch. So this is definitely about what God does for us. Very theological in nature. Don't get your parenting advice from here.
And I agree. I mean, I think Carl had a really good analogy, and I don't mean analogy, but you know, the 12-step concept is, you know, you're always there, right? You're always willing to accept and embrace regardless of the choices that you make. And And I think that's the story behind the parable. You know, it's God's forgiveness. But to one thing about Carl's point, and I can, my personal story in it is, would be my brother, is no matter how much you try to help, that individual has to meet their personal rock bottom before they truly seek the help, has been my experience.
They have to come back. This son came back, whether he was desperate or not. He came back, and that was good enough for his dad. And that's all that matters in this story to me.
Another question tonight, is this the basis for the Amish practice of Rumspringa? Forgive me if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, where teenagers in the Amish tradition have an opportunity to go into the world and decide whether to come back. Any thoughts on that, Brad?
Yeah, that's definitely not a tradition that I'm familiar with, but that may be where they draw it from. But I'm not sure. Like that's just sort of like a rite of passage kind of thing. I don't know. I really don't know. That kind of surprised me a little bit. So
we're gonna have to Google that one. Y'all gonna have to Google that one.
No, I don't. I actually grew up in an Amish community. I was born and raised there. So
sweet.
Shane is like who's the dude that Jordan passed to over in the three? Shane's like Paxson. Jordan just passed to Paxson behind the 3-point line. Go.
So when the teens are allowed to go out and find their way in the world, they're not given half the wealth, because I promise you, the Amish are extremely self-sufficient. So they are not giving half the wealth or half their share. They are given the opportunity to go out and say, okay, is this the life you want to proceed with, or do you want to choose another path? Mm-hmm. So when you go out on your own broke versus given half your wealth or half your share or your portion of the wealth, that's a completely different decision.
Yeah, that absolutely. I can figure that was definitely different. And Brad, would you think it's not half as the second son? Would you think it's maybe a third?
Yeah, it's probably a third. But here's the other kicker to it too, to think about, like, if it was an inheritance, it would be when the father died, which would have included all the fields and the slaves and everything. But because he's not dead yet, he maintains those stay under his. And so the pool of money that would have been the inheritance is even cut down even smaller. And so because he would have had to keep that in order to continue to live. And so it would have been even smaller than a third of the possession. So 2/3 would have gone to the older brother and 1/3 would have gone to the younger of the two.
But Joe, invoking the Amish tradition there is really fascinating, because I think I understand what Shane's saying. They don't give them a certain amount of inheritance, but it's got to be an extreme act of faith on the community's part to let the young people, who are young people and the hormones and the whole thing. I mean, we're parents here. We know and we've been young people, so we know what's going on with the young people. To let them get out there and have confidence that they have raised them correctly, that they are faithful, and that they will get out there and decide and understand and realize this, they really want to go back to their other way of life. It's simple. It's, I don't know, maybe more predictable, less scary, anything like that. Which, by the way, I mean, we could pull that stunt in practically any scenario, regardless of whether we were plain and without electricity as the Amish are, or like my family living in Lake Wylie, South Carolina. You know, do I send my daughter up to New York City and live in Manhattan for a week and see how she likes it? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of the same. It almost is an extreme change in their lifestyle. So it's pretty scary to think in terms of leaving what you know for something drastically different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the other thing is, as you pointed out, Carl, the Amish live a very simple life. There is no internet, no social media, no cell phones, right? And the Amish are not, you know, they're not ignorant to what is, because in my, where I grew up, you know, the Amish come into town and they'll buy certain provisions, and the young children or adolescents or teens, they see us out there, you know, in vehicles and music and stuff. So I'm sure they're probably nowadays, not when I was there, cell phones weren't even a thing. You know, now they understand technology, and you know, I mean, you can form friendships and bonds with the Amish. They're not in your school system, but if they're in your community, you know, you become friends. So there's that interest, that excitement for them on what they have not been, you know, allowed to possess or experience. So I'm sure that's enticing. And to your point, you know, the community, the families, the parents are saying, we have faith in how we raised them, and you know, we're going to give them the opportunity. Do they want what they don't have and what they think they could do better at, or they are going to come back and come home and continue with how we raised them? So, I mean, I think that's a very, very, very good point.
How many of them go back? Come back?
99% of them.
Yeah.
I have only ever met one person, and he was an adult, and something happened with his marriage, and he never shared it. But I worked in the oil fields when I first got out of the Navy, and he was part of the crew on the oil field. And, you know, I he didn't know a lot. He was new to it. You know, I it was my turn to go get lunch, and I'm like, I'll go to Burger King. What do you want? He's like, what do they got? I'm like, what do you mean, what they got? They got Whoppers. He goes, what is that? I go, it's a big cheeseburger. He goes, I want four of them.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, he was the hardest worker to this day I have ever been. The guy had no stopping him. He was extremely polite. You know, he didn't know our world. And I got to learn a lot about their internal community through just conversations with them, and it was extremely interesting. But he left from a marital / family thing. But outside of that, he's the only person I ever known personally to have ever left that, you know, that community, that lifestyle.
Hmm. I looked it up. You're right. It's pushing 90%. So the biggest difference between those two, the community is embracing their walking out and trusting, like Carl said, that fragile nature of what we've believed and done. Whereas this son, no one would be excited, interested. It's just heartache. Heartache that I can't wait for you to die to get my inheritance. Give me what's mine. I want to leave. I'm not writing. It's just painful, heartache. Brad, you've answered some of the things that we've asked. What's something you saw?
Well, anytime I hear this story, I think about what Dr. Amy Jill Levine teaches. She's written a couple of books, one of which about parables, and she talks about the fact that this story is about counting. Because in the previous two, you know, you referenced the idea of the lost sheep, and there's 100 sheep, and then one goes missing, and then there's 10 coins, and one goes missing, and then you're down to two, and one goes missing. And yet at the end of the story, when the party begins to happen, there is still only one son. And so we want to always think about this in terms of, you know, God being the father, but the father fails to count to make sure that the other son is there. And so maybe there is this concept too of like, okay, who are we not including? Who are we leaving out that needs to be included in the love of God that has kind of slipped our mind? Traditionally, the son, the older son is thought to be the Jewish people, and the young son is the, you know, the Gentiles who are now being included. That's like the old ancient traditional way of thinking about this story. So there's a lot kind of that goes on. There's different directions that you could always go when thinking about this story.
Trying to see if there's anything else we circled. I don't think so. Father did not give the son a chance to lay it all out and apologize. Not the best moment for the brother. He said, I've been working like a slave. They have slaves, so I seriously doubt that. He's probably working. He's probably grown up with his dad telling him to grab a tool and go out there and handle something to learn the business. But to suggest that he's been on the level that the people that he has slaves, is that's not great. And I think believers can be that way, that we think we have done more than anyone else. We have been grinding. We have put the work in, and not certain if people who come in and out of the worship space have done that. Perfect example for us to identify with him. Perfect example for us to identify with the one that isolated himself and made poor choices and then had to live with the, I'm guessing it was a surprise, of the conditions of no food. Poor choices times no food is horrible. So he comes back and the whole community celebrates. He was lost and he has been found. Lots of layers there, lots of angles to go. We have the exact opposite in some ways with the second text in terms of the number of verses. And we're going to look at tying that together. Matthew 5, 38 to 42. This is in the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus setting the tone for what his ministry will be with a number of people tuning in on the side of the mountain. You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, give your coat as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to the one who asks of you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. Carl, what do you see there?
That it's almost impossible to be Christ-like.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Because we are not built this way. I mean, I think the way I was brought up, I was taught about original sin and all the things that go in with humanity and being human. And we this is some of the hardest thing that Jesus is asking of us ever. I mean, you think in terms of what we try to teach our children when they're toddlers. And they're in the sandbox and one of them pushes the other one down and the one lands on their butt and they cry, you know, and they get back up and they push the other one and they're starting to be, I mean, it's what we do. We're human. It's what we do. And Jesus is saying, quit being human. Give of everyone. And oh, by the way, the lost son story is makes me worry about this too. Brad, your daughter's frustration with the son is warranted, because what this does, what Jesus' teaching does to me in this world, is it opens up Christians to be taken advantage of in our real world. It's extremely difficult to follow what Jesus has asked us to do here. And doggone it, I think some of us are lazy enough just to give up and just say, you know, forget it. This is too hard. It is really eye-opening when you read this passage and go, oh, we're supposed to behave like this? That's what I see.
You see parallels between the way the father and the prodigal son story behaved and the prescription for behavior in this? Is that the connection, Brad? Or do you think they're not as similar as I'm suggesting?
No, I mean, I don't know that they're quite that similar. I think the whole topic this week is about foolish love is prodigal, in that it is almost wastefully extravagant. And so the father's love is kind of prodigal. The way in which the father receives the young son back, the way in which the father wants to include the older son in the celebration, like all of that is definitely a different way of thinking about that word prodigal. This is out of the Sermon on the Mount. And what is being offered here is actually just an alternative view of the world. It's an alternative view of how to interact with the world. And I can, you know, if you want me to, we can break it all down and talk about all the different parts, because it's pretty intriguing that in these five verses, like, it's all packed full. I mean, it's almost like a sermon unto itself. That includes three examples, about the turning of the cheek, about, you know, giving a coat as well. And then also the going a second mile. All three of those things would have made complete and total sense in Jesus's day. They don't all mean exactly what we think they mean. It's almost like a third way of fighting. In fact, there's a writer, Walter Wink, a writer and theologian, Walter Wink, and referring to this passage alone, he talks about what's called Jesus's third way. And so in a dualistic world, Jesus offers an alternative, like a third way of thinking about things.
That's what we said tonight. It's neither fight nor flight. And we said that because one of the participants said he doesn't cower. He's not slapping back. He's not fighting back, but he's also not leaving. So the human nature to get out the biggest weapon and take it to that person, whatever it may be, verbally, physically, financially, sort of weapon, it's not prescribing that, and it's not prescribing running either. And the path that Jesus takes into Jerusalem, the people that he faces, doesn't stop walking in that direction, but he also doesn't come bearing a weapon. I think there's a lot of parallels to that.
So just from the top, like that verse 38 or verse 39 doesn't seem to fit, where he says, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Or do not resist evil. Like the word resist there, the Greek word is anthistemi, which means warfare. And so in essence, what he's saying is do not commit warfare on an evil person. It's like, do not fight on their terms. Instead, here's what you should do. And then he gives three examples. And I mean, you want to go through them real quick just so that I can explain them to you pretty quick, I think. Right?
Please, please.
Okay. So if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, well, in their day and age, the majority of people were right-handed. Everybody used their right hand to do things. The left hand was considered unclean. So in order for me to slap you on your right cheek, it meant I had to use the back of my hand, right? Which would have been a sign that you were inferior to me. But if you offered me your left cheek, gave me your other cheek, in order for me to strike you, I would either have to do it with my palm of my right hand or with my fist, which would mean that you are my equal. So for one who is thinking that they are above someone else and will slap them with the back of their hand, for that other person, for the person who is slapped to say, no, you need to hit this side of my face, would be challenging the person to say, no, I am your equal. Secondly, if you want to sue and you take your coat, hand over your coat as well, or sue and take your shirt, then hand over your coat. Basically, the word there that's being used is not always translated the right way, but what he's saying is also offer your undergarment, which means you're going to be left naked. Now, if you're being left naked in the Jewish tradition in particular, the nakedness caused the embarrassment to be upon the one who looked upon the naked body or caused the body to be naked, not upon the one who was left naked. Thank you, Puritans. We have a fascination in which we think being naked is embarrassing. In that culture, in that tradition, it wasn't embarrassing for the person who was naked. It was embarrassing for those who looked upon the person. You can think about the old story of Noah and his sons and what happens after the ark. If you don't know what that story is, go back to Genesis and read it. Right? So there's some creativity here about trying to bring equality amongst people. And then the last part is the carrying the pack the second mile. This does not mean go above and beyond. That's not what this means. Instead, the occupying force of Rome could force anyone to do anything they wanted them to do or needed them to do. They could force them into some kind of service. And so, I mean, think about Simon the Cyrene, who is just simply sitting there watching Jesus as he falls, carrying the cross. He's thrust into duty. He's forced to carry the cross. One of the things that Roman soldiers typically did was it forced citizens to carry their packs, but they could only do it for 1 mile. After a second mile, or to go a second mile would have inevitably gotten the soldier in trouble. Or at bare minimum, it would have made it awkward for the soldier. So now the soldier, who is somebody who's authority, somebody who's a power over, is now put in an awkward position by you carrying the pack a second mile. So it's literally just a different way of fighting the powers of this world by trying to restore people's dignity in those moments.
Does kill them with kindness apply here?
I mean, that is kind of what it is. I typically don't like that just because it's still trying to kill them. That was the other one in which it's like, what's the passage where it talks about heap, if you do this, you'll heap burning coals on their heads, which is like, that's super painful. Like that's still, you know, taking advantage and causing harm. So I don't necessarily know that that's kind of what is being talked about them. But yes, it is like trying to do an alternative from fighting and an alternative from running away and fleeing.
Just
by Romans 12.
I'm sorry, Joe.
Yeah. I just want to say it, and then Carl wants you to go. Romans 12. But I'm looking at King James. I'll do King James. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Romans 12:20. Go, Carl.
Yeah, I think anytime you react counter to what someone expects. It puts them in a weird position. And that's what these verses kind of describe. It's not backing away. It's not running. It's not fleeing, but it's kind of one-upping them. When I say kill them with kindness, I understand what you mean about that killing still being violent, but not beating them with kindness.
What about rather than to kindness too? What about defiance? I mean, it is defiance. You cannot take me. I will continue to exceed what this is. You will continue. I am not moving. I'm right here.
Yeah. Yeah. It is defiance, but it's not eye for eye defiance. It's not tooth for tooth. It's something different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a martial arts person, but it's like using someone's body weight against them. Jiu-jitsu. Stepping to the side and jiu-jitsu. Stepping aside and let them fall to the mat.
Which, Brad, you're still going to say, yep, it's still not about tackling them, right?
Yes, I mean, yeah.
We keep violent, doing that.
Right? I mean, but that's how challenging this is, right? Like, that's how this is the point of this. I mean, Carl, you led with that of like, dude, following Jesus, not easy, right? Like, what he's asking us to do in this moment. And this part is just hard.
All right. So given you did not pass the ball to Paxton, like you just took the ball and did what you did with that tech. Is there more in the four verses that you just broke down than in the 21 verses that we read before? Theologically.
I mean, it's a part of a bigger story that what the Sermon on the Mount is. So like we're reading like just a few verses of the Sermon on the Mount, which is this large story of an alternative way of living. And Jesus gives an example here. And he does it over this concept of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which was, you know, I would want to give credit where credit is due. Where when that came about, like, you know, I think probably learned in school about Hammurabi's code and Lex Talionis, the idea like it didn't used to be that way. You know, like it used to be that if I did something and knocked your eye out, you would come and like cut my arm off.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would mean somebody would then go cut your two arms off. And it just, so violence was always escalated. And along came this idea, and some people would attribute it to Moses. I don't necessarily think that, you know, it has to be Moses. Moses probably used it. It may have been before Moses. It could have been, I don't know. But this idea of an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth actually saved lives because it de-escalated the violence. Jesus is just now taking it to another level. Again, you've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, but I tell you, we're not playing those games anymore. Here's what I want you to do instead. And it's just an alternative. So
yeah, elevate.
Yeah. So
I'll make one last pitch. Father, would you guess it's not in there. Would you guess the farmer, the wealth and land of the farmer is generational, like that show with Kevin Costner.
Yellowstone.
It's generational. And this kid says, give me what's mine in the moment. You'd be inclined to be verbally or physically violent in that moment, and the son would be in the brother would be inclined to be verbally or physically violent. But these two texts aren't tied together, but the theme tied them together. And I wonder about the sacrificing the thing that would come naturally to us when a person does something so difficult for us to process that emotion wells up within us, yet the Father doesn't do it and sets the tone for the potential of human relationships based on the love that God gives us.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, again, we want to talk about the parable of the prodigal son as being like a real life thing that happened, but it's Jesus telling a story that has a point.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's that point? Yeah. Like the point is like, God's not going to react like God, like we expect God to. Mm-hmm. And our call is not to react the way that everybody expects us to live counterculturally. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think you're on. I like the way in which those track together.
You know, we've been talking about these two stories or two passages for almost an hour now. And I think we could go another hour in talking about how the father set the tone and the son didn't lose his mind at first. The older son just went about his business and handled his business. And it wasn't until the younger son came back and was embraced that he had a problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
The father was setting the tone even at the beginning of the story. He was doing something that most families wouldn't do.
Incredibly okay. generous.
You want your share? You're still a youngin', but go ahead. Have at it. I love you. That's I don't know what just came to me, but that's interesting.
It's powerful. Powerful. All right. Well, we'll see. Is it you or Megan this week, Brad?
Megan is on for this week.
All right. So we'll see what Megan does with it. We'll see what I do with it. Podcasts come out Tuesday nights late. Catch it Wednesday morning. Sermon audio comes out Sunday afternoon or Monday morning. That sermon audio is always going to have the link to YouTube, to Bethel United Methodist in Spartanburg, to make sure, if you want to watch, the service in its entirety, the contemporary service, traditional service at Bethel, mine is the sermon audio, from one of my churches, depending on how that audio worked out at either one. We will meet at Three Friends next week. Unless I email otherwise, I expect to be in town. Thank you guys for joining, offering your perspective. Thank you everyone for listening. Hope you have a great week and join us again next week.